from WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Each month, we check in with the reporters at Nature News for a roundup of recent science headlines. This time around, our producer Elsa Partan spoke with Nature's multimedia editor, Shamini Bundell.
Welcome back, Shamini.
Hi, thanks for having me, Elsa.
Researchers at McGill University are showing that male and female mice experience pain through different pathways. This could help change the way we manage pain in men and women.
Yeah, I found this a really quite surprising study from my experience. You sort of tend to think of pain as someone pokes you, maybe sticks a needle in you and you sort of go, ow, and it's all sort of nerve-based. But obviously, you know, you'd expect men and women to have the same kind of nerves. So when these researchers found different reactions between male and female mice, they kind of figured there was something else going on there.
And what is going on?
Well, the thing that they came up with as one of the main factors is the immune cells that are involved in pain. So this is actually more likely to be involved in things like chronic pain, which is obviously, you know, quite a big problem for a lot of people. And interestingly, chronic pain is quite a big problem for women in particular. It's mostly women who experience it. So when these researchers were looking at male and female mice, they found that different immune cells in the mice were part of the pain pathway. So, for example, they were looking at male mice with hypersensitivity and found that an immune cell called microglia were involved. Whereas when they looked at the female mice, microglia weren't involved, and it seemed to be T cells, which is another type of immune cell.
And are researchers thinking that this might actually be the same thing in people?
Well, this study was only done in mice, and it's sort of slightly more difficult in people to do. But one of the most important things is that they are actually looking for these differences. So a lot of the time, if you're doing experiments with mice, you might think, oh, I'll just use male mice. It's probably the same. It's going to be easier just to sort of have male mice, and they used to think, well, they don't have as many hormonal fluctuations, so that'll be much simpler. Whereas now that they've realized there's a difference, more and more people are making sure that they actually look for the differences. And it's the same with people. If you're doing a study with a whole bunch of people and you testing a pain medication maybe or a pain treatment, and you know, maybe it does okay, but it's not doesn't look like it's particularly good, you might find, oh, it's working actually really well in men but not in women. So looking for those differences is really important.
I'm talking with Shamini Bundell from Nature News. Here's another story that's gotten a lot of attention this week. Paleontologists have been working on a mystery. Almost everyone agrees that dinosaurs went extinct when a huge asteroid hit the Earth, but they can't find any dinosaur bones in that geological layer leading right up to there. Now, one scientist working in North Dakota says he's found a big deposit of fossils that shows the exact moment the asteroid hit. What did he find?
Well, this is a really cool find in North Dakota, and it's basically a sort of fossilized jumble of a whole load of fish, so freshwater fish, marine life, vegetation, all kind of stuck together, and it includes in there little pieces of glass that we think came from this asteroid hitting the Earth. It was sort of like molten rock, essentially. And all this suggests, so the glass, the mixture of stuff, that these animals died and were dumped here at the time that asteroid hit the Earth.
Wow, which is really it would be the first time that this has been seen.
Yeah, it's incredible that you've captured that sort of snapshot in moment of such a significant sort of historical event.
Are there any dinosaurs in there?
Well, so the current paper that has just come out, that the reporting is on, is about this, about the fish and then the water life. The dinosaurs is the big question, though, because one of the sort of mysteries of this big extinction is that just before the extinction, if you look in the rocks, there aren't dinosaur bones around. And some people have said, well, you know, maybe it wasn't really the extinction that killed them. Maybe they were kind of already going extinct due to various other things, and that's why we haven't seen them. Now, the paleontologist who has announced this find, Robert De Palma, has said that there are dinosaur bones in this geological layer, suggesting that the dinosaurs were thriving right up until that moment. Now, that's not been published in this paper, so it's not been peer-reviewed. No one's seen these results yet. But that's a very possibly exciting announcement still to come.
We'll be watching for that. I'm talking with Nature News editor Shamini Bundell. Here's another story we're following. Researchers report that children have lower social mobility later in life when they grow up in a neighborhood with high levels of lead and violence and neighborhoods in which a lot of adults go to jail. It's not the first study of its kind, but what's different about this one?
Yeah, so, you know, everyone is interested in, you know, trying to find out why there might be social mobility in some cases and not in others. You know, how do we encourage social mobility? How do we stop poverty just sort of keeping going? And this study looks, as you've mentioned, some kind of unusual factors, because people have studied this before and people look at if your parents are poor, you're going to have less advantages growing up. That might cause a decrease in social ability. If your community is poor, that might have a factor as well. Whereas, you know, the particular things that these guys have pulled out, so like lead, they looked at lead levels in children's blood and found that that was a good predictor for future social mobility. They looked at the neighbourhoods that the children were growing up in, the levels of adult incarceration in those neighbourhoods, the level of violence in those neighbourhoods, and they found that where these kids were living was just as good a predictor as maybe the personal family effects or maybe just poverty effects. So it's something that people hadn't looked at so much before.
Well, do they have any conclusions about what should be done?
Well, I mean, that's the key question, isn't it? And some of the things that they were looking for were whether particular factors could help. So they were looking at whether there's a sort of a sense of community cohesion and trust in the neighbours and organised community activities and whether those kind of things helped with this social mobility. And they did find some correlations. But the fact that they've found that this sort of neighbourhood effect of where people are growing up and what other adults in that community are doing are such a big impact kind of implies that maybe that's where the focus should be for improvements going forward.
That's multimedia editor for Nature News, Shamini Bundell. Thanks, Shamini.
Thanks.
Coming up, we don't have enough people of color in medical studies, and that's making things worse for everyone. That's coming up on Living Lab Radio after a short break.
This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Nearly 4 out of 5 people represented in human genetic research are of European descent. That's the result of a recent analysis that also found 10% are of Asian descent, while people of African, Hispanic, and all other ethnicities together make up less than 6%. Less than 6%. Unfortunately, it's no surprise that non-European populations are underrepresented in biomedical research of many sorts. But these numbers are striking, and the authors say it's a major impediment to understanding how genes cause disease and how such diseases can be treated. In short, it poses a health risk. Sarah Tishkoff is the David and Lynn Silfen Professor in the Department of Genetics and Biology at the University of Pennsylvania. She also serves as a director for the American Society for Human Genetics. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here.
It's, as I said, not a surprise that the pool of genetic data that we have is skewed toward those of European descent. But 78%, were you surprised by just how biased our data set is?
Well, yes and no, because the focus of my research has been on studying genomic diversity in Africa. And the reason that I've been doing this for my entire career is because I recognize that populations from that region are underrepresented. There had been a study a few years back that had shown a bias towards people of European ancestry. But what was shocking to me is I thought in the last several years, as the number of studies have increased, that it would have gotten a lot better. And the surprise to me was that it wasn't that much better. It's still at roughly 80% of the studies that look at genetic associations with disease are focused on people of European ancestry.
And why do you think it has not gotten any better?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. I think the top reason is that most of this research is being done in the U.S. and in Europe, and there's going to be a focus on the populations that are in the majority in those regions. However, there can be some other reasons as well, and one of them could be just an issue of funding and priority by the funding agencies. So I think if funding agencies were to say, this is our top priority, we need to include people of diverse ancestries, that perhaps there would be more of a focus on trying to do that. There has also in the past been some, I would say, biases against, in that it has been known that when you include people of diverse ancestries, in what's called a genome-wide association study that it can be prone towards false positive results.
And what exactly does that mean?
False positive results meaning that I might find that a genetic variant is associated with the disease. And if so, I think that the variant that's actually causing that disease is located nearby in a chromosome. But this could be a false association if I haven't properly accounted for the fact that you have genetic heterogeneity in your sample.
Basically, the research is simpler if you have a simpler sample to work with. But on the other hand, I mean, science should reflect reality, and reality is that the human population is diverse. So the science needs to reflect that in order to be accurate, doesn't it?
That's absolutely true. And there are ways to overcome that bias using statistical approaches. Another issue is that there's more power when doing these association studies when you have a larger number of individuals. So you tend to have fewer numbers of individuals when looking at minority populations, and therefore you don't have as much power to find an association, and therefore you may not score as well, for example, when you apply for a grant to fund that research.
Hmm. Sarah Tishkoff, in the commentary that you wrote for the journal Cell, you argue that the lack of diversity in genetic data impairs our ability to understand disease and how genes cause disease, and that it actually impairs our ability to understand it in several different ways. The most obvious is perhaps that we would miss a disease-causing gene or gene variant that exists primarily in one population that isn't being studied adequately. But you say there are other ways that it can distort our understanding. What are some of those other ways?
One of the ways is that nowadays there's a move towards precision or personalized medicine. And as part of that, people are estimating what's called polygenic risk scores. What they have done is for all those variants in the genome that they've tested, they get a score, let's say. And that score is going to say whether you're at increased risk or decreased risk if you have that variant. So what you can essentially do is add up all the different variants that a person has. And if you have a lot of variants that are associated with disease risk, then the clinician might say, okay, you're at much higher risk for this disease. But the problem is that because of our evolutionary history, our demographic history, we know that all modern humans originated in Africa in the past few hundred thousand years, and that relatively small numbers migrated out of Africa within the past 80,000 years. And that really affected the pattern of variation that we see in global populations. So you tend to see more genetic diversity in Africa, both within and between populations, and you tend to see a subset of that variation outside of Africa. But as people migrate into different regions, they may accumulate new variation, and also they have different patterns of association between variants. So what that means is when they calculate those polygenic risk scores in people of European ancestry, they may not translate well to other ethnic groups. So that means that if someone gives a person a polygenic risk score estimate based on studies that were done in other ethnic groups, it could actually be wrong or misleading. I think the main effect is that people are not going to know how at risk they really are for a disease.
Sarah Tishkoff, obviously there are multiple reasons, as we said, going back just to the fundamental reason that in order for science to reflect reality, it needs to reflect the diversity of humans. But how do we actually accomplish that? I mean, especially when we talk about in the United States trying to engage minority populations in genetic research, there is a long history of neglect of these populations, of outright exploitation, and a lot of mistrust. So how do you propose that you and your colleagues, genetic researchers, begin to overcome that?
That is absolutely true. And there are a lot of valid reasons why there would be mistrust. I personally think that one of the most important things is to have genetic researchers and scientists who reflect that diversity. I think people are going to trust people who look more like them. That's a more general problem in the field, that we need to increase diversity. I also think that we need to make sure that research is done in a very ethical manner. I think that we need to include social scientists, for example. We need to make sure that the community is involved, truly involved in this research and understands why it's being done, what the possible benefits are and the risks, and that they take a lead, that they should be the ones hopefully pushing for this research, and that they would have a vested interest in this research because they know it's going to benefit them. But that takes a lot of careful discussion, and it can take a long time to build up trust.
Well, Sarah Tishkoff, you serve as a director for the American Society of Human Genetics, and at that group's annual meeting a few months ago, there was a whole morning of discussion dedicated to this topic. Are there concrete steps coming out of things like that discussion and this commentary that the scientific community is really taking hold of and moving forward with?
Actually, I think that there are a number of steps that are being taken. And in fact, you know, I must say that I was almost taken aback by the response to this commentary, which was so strong. And we heard from so many different people, ranging from business people to the research scientist community and just, you know, the general community. People thought this is really important and that we need to do something about it. And I know that certainly NIH takes this issue very seriously, and they have made it a top priority to increase diversity in their research programs. Some examples of that include the TopMed initiative. This is the largest genome sequencing project to date in the U.S., where they're looking for associations with cardiovascular, lung, and blood disorders. And they've really made it an absolute priority to have diversity in that sample set, and they've done an excellent job. And I'm actually part of that initiative. The other thing is the All of Us initiative at NIH is really trying to make sure that there's ethnic diversity is represented, and not just ethnic diversity. It should be diversity at all levels, socioeconomic diversity and so on. And then also the H3 Africa initiative, which has been funded by NIH, which has put a lot of money into building up genomics research that is led by African scientists focused on African populations.
Obviously, doing biomedical research can take time. When might we start to see a change, a significant change in the data that we have available and the way that that translates into, you know, new biomedical products, new therapies, and new ways of treating disease?
Well, I think I see that change already happening now. I would like to see it happen a bit more quickly, and I think it's going to take a concerted effort. But if we make it a top priority, I think we can change things relatively quickly. And I'm hopeful. As I said, I was a little disappointed that we didn't see as much change in the last few years as I had hoped. But we could only hope that in the future, things will change more rapidly.
Sarah Tishkoff is the David and Lynn Silfen Professor in the Department of Genetics and Biology at the University of Pennsylvania. Sarah, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Human exploration of the moon is once again an American pursuit. Vice President Pence has said he'd like to see Americans on the moon in 5 years. We've been here before, but it's been a while. Just over 50 years since Apollo 8 carried American astronauts out of Earth's orbit and around the moon, giving humanity our first glimpse of our home planet from outer space. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC with a lifelong interest in space exploration, and he decided to speak with the Apollo astronauts, now in their 80s and 90s. He didn't just want to recount the astronauts' old lunar missions. He wanted to reflect on what we can learn from their journeys. His new book is The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Heather.
24 men went to or orbited the moon, and you call them the Eagles. What was it you wanted to learn from the Eagles?
I wanted to hit on the existential questions. I wanted to examine the anatomy of courage and the true source of courage. And what I discovered from all of them, they kept citing the common good and believing in something greater than oneself. The most interesting quote came from Neil Armstrong about the future of space exploration, and he said that he believed that we had not evolved enough as a species to colonize the rest of the universe. He says, what is it that we're going to be exporting? So there are some really fascinating takes there. with Armstrong, I think, being the most interesting of all. I describe him as a quiet genius.
Each chapter in The Mission of a Lifetime actually starts with bullet-pointed key lessons. What made you decide to frame the story this way?
I thought it would be helpful for readers, particularly younger readers who are unfamiliar with the missions, with the astronauts themselves, and some of their what I consider to be brilliant insights. And also some very key lessons on how to conquer one's fear. These men were not fearless. They knew fear, and the flight surgeons were able to measure it during their mission. So, for example, when Neil Armstrong was attempting the first moon landing, his heart rate shot up to 165. What they had all learned and trained to do was to manage and black box their fear. And it is something that has really been done ever since World War I, when Winston Churchill's doctor, Lord Moran, did the first exploration of the anatomy of courage. And what he discovered was what we would call today mindfulness, the ability to focus intently on what's in front of you, and in the case of pilots, their instruments, and to not be sidelined by your imagination, what if thinking. And the Apollo astronauts were very good at that.
It's interesting, all of the medical attention, psychological training that was going toward the astronauts, the wives got nothing. And yet, at least one astronaut said, you know, the wives had to be at least as brave. They didn't know the mission inside out. They weren't there. There was no, you know, button they could push if something went wrong to try to make things better. It was complete uncertainty, and it really took its toll. A huge divorce rate among these early astronauts, mental breakdowns, at least one suicide. And you talked with some of the wives. Was that something that was originally part of your project, or did that come out of talking with the astronauts?
No, I had suspected that their story was as important to tell as their husbands, because had it not been for them, they could not have accomplished what they did. So they were there completely supportive. And interestingly, the Air Force handbook, the wives' handbook, and it really was a manual that was used in all of the services, quite specifically said to avoid marital squabbles, because it would in effect impact their husband's ability to focus and concentrate while they were flying these aircraft. So,
I mean, they really had to sacrifice themselves for the sake of their husband's well-being and state of mind during their missions.
That's exactly right. And they, too, believed in the common good and something greater than oneself. And it was, in this case, it was the Cold War mission of beating the Russians. But beyond that, I think there is a grace and a sensibility that they displayed. So I think it's worth reminding people.
Basil Hero, you ended up interviewing almost every living astronaut who went to the moon, as well as their colleagues, their loved ones. You've already mentioned Neil Armstrong as one person who really stood out to you. Were there others, and what made them stand out?
I would say Alan Bean, who was the fourth moonwalker and had become an artist, was also probably the most reflective thinker, along with Armstrong, of the bunch. And he made a very interesting point, and the same thing with Mike Collins, that we are living in the Garden of Eden, and we have just yet to appreciate it, so that when they were out there for 10, 12 days in a vacuum-sealed environment and breathing nothing but pure oxygen, when they returned to Earth, they realized that they were, in fact, in paradise. And Jim Lovell, who was on Apollo 13, made an extraordinary statement. He said, you know, after 50 years looking back, the conclusion I've come to is that you don't go to heaven when you die. You go to heaven when you are born. And I talked to the dean of the Yale Divinity School, Greg Sterling, and I said, have you ever heard this formulation? He says, no, never. It's quite quite incredible. And interestingly, what has happened in the theology schools, there is a new movement called eco-theology, and it is a direct result of the Apollo missions and the photos that they took of Earth from deep space.
Basil Hero, it's interesting that you mention the fourth moonwalker as one of the most reflective. We often hear so much about the first person to go into space and the first person to set foot on the moon. But sometimes it was those intervening missions or the ones that followed up that ended up being really important. And I'm thinking in particular about Apollo 8, which didn't land on the moon, but was the first time that humans went around the moon. And in addition to getting amazing photographs of the moon to lay the groundwork for landing on the moon, they also got the first photographs and the first real glimpse of the Earth from space. And just as you're saying, this realization of how small, how blue and green, how filled with life our planet is, those pictures of Earth from space, those first pictures of the Earth from space, really launched the environmental movement and apparently really changed some of the astronauts who are on that mission.
It did, absolutely. It was kind of a Galilean moment in reverse. They went to explore the moon and really discovered the Earth. They saw it as the real prize in the sky. And it altered their perception of time, of happiness. Suddenly, you know, they realized that all of the earthly squabbles that we engage in are, in effect, meaningless. That the whole notion, when you're looking at the Earth from 240,000 miles out, you wonder whether it's even inhabited, let alone being able to pick your country on the globe. So the idea of countries, nations, borders, races, just became a ludicrous concept in their minds. It was, we are one. We are one planetary race.
Basil Hero, you've interviewed nearly all of the Apollo astronauts for this book, The Mission of a Lifetime. And this commonality of kind of the spirituality of it, the different view of our planet and the appreciation for our planet really comes through. But there's one astronaut whose views kind of stands out as different, and that's Harrison Schmitt. He is a vocal climate change denier, and as recently as last year said that he saw no evidence that global warming was the result of human activity. How did you navigate? I mean, did that come up in your conversation with him?
Well, I tried. Harrison Schmitt is a really interesting case. He was the only geologist, the only scientist of the 24 who went out there and of the 12 who walked on the moon. He has always maintained that the glacial sort of changes that occur are just part of Earth's geological history. So he's softening a little bit, saying that perhaps man's climate change and pollution has served perhaps as a bit of an accelerator, but that it is not the main cause of climate change. So for me, it was rather frustrating to have that conversation with him. And he really doesn't want to go there because I guess he's getting beaten up by everybody. So I was not able to really do a deep dive into his thinking on this. He almost cuts you off when you want to get to the conversation.
Basil Hero, we so frequently hear from astronauts that since they were a kid, they wanted to go into space. They always wanted to walk on the moon. They always wanted to go to the space station. There's one astronaut who stands out as kind of apathetic about space and says he really just did it to beat the Russians. And after that, you know, he was out. He was actually one of the only ones to quit. What was it like talking with him?
Well, Frank Borman is the one that you're referring to. And Frank really was, you know, he was an exacting West Pointer. And he was deeply, deeply committed to beating the Russians to the moon. The other aggravating factor for him was his wife, Susan, who had a nervous breakdown and essentially said to him, please do not go back out into space. And he had been offered the first moon landing and he turned it down, which is quite something. Borman however, was profoundly changed by the experience. And even when he addressed Congress, he read from Archibald MacLeish's passage about us being riders on the earth together, and that we had to find the capacity to cooperate globally as one, you know, collective civilization. So that was quite a statement coming from Frank Borman, who, you know, was not given to soft-headed thinking. I found him to be one of the more fascinating of the group. It was also touching to see how, for the first time in his life, he really kind of hung his head in resignation, saying that, you know, I've been able to get out of every tough situation. There wasn't anything that I couldn't solve, except for one, which is my wife's Alzheimer's. And it was really the only note of defeat that I think I've ever come across in any interviews with him. So it was quite a touching interview with him.
As we look into the next 5, 10, 15 years of space exploration with NASA's sights set on going back to the moon, but really as a stepping stone to going to Mars, did you speak with these astronauts about our future space exploration, and how are they feeling about that?
Well, the majority of them believe that the moon is the best staging area for future exploration of the rest of the solar system. They are less convinced that Mars is the place to go straight away, avoiding the moon, for the simple reason that too many things have yet to be solved. The radiation issue, it's a 9-month trip out there, and the radiation in deep space is far worse than it is in that cislunar corridor between the Earth and the moon. The other thing, of course, is that you have to live subterraneally. And then to be able to resupply a Mars base can only happen every 2 years. So the logistics of it are daunting. The other issue that, frankly, has yet to be fully resolved is whether or not men and women can live in deep space for an extended period of time.
Lots of questions and perhaps a note of caution being sounded by the men who went to the moon. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC and author of The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, thanks so much.
And thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, Heather. I appreciate it.
Up next, the neuroscience of addiction, as told by someone who has both studied it and lived it. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Government statistics suggest that 1 in 10 Americans is struggling with addiction. The CDC estimates that excessive alcohol use cost almost $250 billion in 2010, and opioid overdoses last year overtook car accidents as the leading cause of accidental deaths in the U.S. Our understanding of how addiction plays out in the brain has increased dramatically in recent years, but that hasn't translated into treatment options. Judy Grizel is in a unique position to appreciate both the challenges and the stakes involved in addiction research. She's a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at Bucknell University, but in her early 20s, she was a college dropout and daily drug user. Her new book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction, is equal parts textbook and memoir. Judy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thank you.
Your book opens with a pretty harrowing account of your descent into addiction, starting with the first time that you got drunk as a 13-year-old. 30 years later, do you have, at this point, an understanding of what happened and why you, of all of your peers who maybe drank in high school, ended up in such a dire state by your early 20s?
Well, I have a much better understanding than I did certainly when I hit bottom. And I guess my understanding gets better and better every year, but it is still difficult to predict exactly who's going to develop a problem and who's not. I think there are lots of biological risk factors and lots of environmental risk factors, and I just seem to be one of those 1 in 10, as you say, that had an unlucky hand, I guess.
And you say when you hit bottom, what was the bottom for you?
Well, it was kind of a long, drawn-out, unfolding disaster, but I'd say the lowest point for me was after I had stopped injecting cocaine because of a terrible near-death and lots of legal problems experience. And as a result, though, of not using cocaine so avidly, I was able to scrape together some money with some friends and get an apartment.
And we should say you'd been homeless for a period.
I'd been homeless for a while, yeah, kind of on and off, but most of, 2 or 3 years. And anyway, with the apartment, I had a mirror. And one day, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you kind of look right into yourself and it looks like, who is that stranger staring back at me? Mm-hmm. So I had that look, but instead of seeing kind of a friendly or benign stranger, I saw a very lost self, and so lost that I didn't even recognize myself. And I felt kind of in the pit of my stomach just an absolute sinking feeling of self-loathing for sure, but also kind of despair. And I think that even though for about 10 years I'd been arranging my life just the way I liked it and using all I could pretty much all the time, that despair was hard to ignore. And I spent about another 3 months trying to tamp it down with as much chemical as I could get in me, but I was unsuccessful at that. So I kind of had a moment of reckoning, I guess.
You describe yourself as, for those years, pretty much using any drug you could get your hands on, as much as you could get your hands on. And in order to make that possible, winnowing down friends, and even for that matter, becoming estranged from your family, winnowing away anyone who would not support your behavior. And yet you say it was a visit with your father that helped turn you around. What happened?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess that we are social creatures, and it must have, deep down under all the chemicals, I must have been missing those connections. Because when my father surprisingly offered to take me out to dinner on my 23rd birthday, and we hadn't spoken really in a few years. In fact, the way I remember it is, if people would ask him if he had any kids, he would say he had 2 sons. He wouldn't even kind of allude to me. I think it was so painful. So, and I sort of understood. We were definitely estranged. But for some reason, he decided to take me out. And I was very much braced for the interaction. I was full of self-righteousness. It's kind of hard to believe now, but I wasn't at all open to warmth. I guess I thought he sort of owed me a dinner, really. And and he surprised us both. In fact, he doesn't remember this, and no one in my family, my brothers and I, all kind of think about it like, how did this happen? But he said, you know, I really just want you to be happy, which I think is his core hope for me, but it never was able to express itself under all the other directions and critiques and criticism, you know, everything else. So when he said that, because I had had that image of myself in the mirror that I was unable to blot out, I just sort of fell apart. And I sure didn't expect that. And I didn't know what the outcome would be. And I don't think he did too much either. But my dear mother, who'd been researching treatment centers since I was about 15, was ready in the wings. Mm-hmm. She wasn't at the dinner, but she had a plan, and they together took me to treatment. And I said, this is in the late 80s, so it's hilarious to me now, but I had never heard of a treatment center, and I thought it might be like a spa, you know, where I would get, you know, extra treatment. When I saw the nurses, I was kind of backing out the door, but I was in the middle of nowhere, so I decided to stick it out, and that really was the beginning of my transformation.
And at some point in that transformation, the idea occurs to you that there might be a cure for addiction and you might be the one who could find it. And that set you on a path eventually to college and graduate school. I mean, that's really a remarkable turnaround. Where do you think that idea came from?
Well, I think that idea would come pretty much to any addict who was cornered like I felt. My whole life was about using, And even though I ended up in treatment, I wasn't really intending to live the rest of my life without mind-altering chemicals. So I figured I could understand it better and somehow game things. So when I heard in treatment that people thought I had a disease and that I might not be able to use without self-destructing, I think my mind, typical of most people like me, thought there's got to be a back door, there's got to be another way. You know, I had gotten through lots of tricky situations, and this was definitely one of those, and I thought, okay, I got a disease, I'll fix it. Which, you know, you alluded to this earlier, but I had been kicked out of 3 schools by this time. If I had a GPA, you know, it was full of F's and D's and a few A's if I was really interested, but I don't think it was 2.0. So why I thought that I could do this was more a testament to my determination to use than it was to anything, you know, admirable.
Judy Grizzell, you write that you chose to become a neuroscientist specifically because the prevailing view at that point was pretty much that, as you've mentioned, addiction was a disease of the brain and that our brain kind of determines who we are and what our life looks like. And instead, you say now the prevailing view and your view is not so much that the brain is the determiner, but that the brain is the stage on which our life plays out. What do you mean by that?
I, as a neuroscientist, along with all of the rest of us, I think we believe that, and we know that everything we experience has a neural correlate. That means that the electrical and chemical signals in the brain are correlated with all that we think and feel and do. So that's clear, including our addictive behaviors. What we used to think was that the brain was causing all those things kind of on its own as some master, you know, Oz behind the curtain. But now we really understand how our brain is a function of our environments and our experiences and our social interactions and our even our gut microbiome, our immune system. So we've widened our perspective quite a lot.
I mean, this is the idea of plasticity, right? That our brain does influence our perceptions and our actions and our thoughts, but then everything that we experience feeds back and actually changes our brain.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with plasticity. And I guess what everybody appreciates probably by now is that the brain influences and contributes to our behaviors, let's say, in our thoughts and our feelings. But it's also the other way around, that our behaviors, thoughts, and feelings influence the structure and function of our brain. So it's really a bidirectional relationship.
And you write about one particular aspect of this back and forth between the brain and our environment or our experiences that centers around something that has actually become, I think, kind of a common idea, that we kind of have a happiness set point, that we're all kind of trying to maintain this kind of even keel. And you write that the brain actually does this in what seemed to me like just bizarre and astounding ways. It's like an equal and opposite reaction. For every happy thing that we experience, our brain like manufactures a negative to bring us back to that initial set point.
Yes, that's right, Heather. There's kind of a lot to that. Probably 50 years ago, psychologists recognized that people who are kind of happy kids tend to be happy adults, and sad kids, you know, tend to be sad adults. This is sort of a persistent facet of our personality, just our baseline mood. And we've also noticed that if something terrific happens or something terrible happens, there's a little blip in that mood, but it's temporary. And we sort of go right back to where we were, almost no matter what happens. So that's been appreciated for a while, but the way that we understand it now is that stable state is due to the brain's ability to counteract any kind of perturbation that causes happiness or sadness. And the reason for that, you could probably imagine, is that if we were just bouncing around from elated to despairing all of the time, it would be really hard to tell if something important was happening. So if we need to pay attention to some really good news or to some really bad event that happens, but we didn't have a stable baseline, it'd be hard to tell. And the brain is all about trying to decide if something is happening, something important is happening. So in order to note important events, this stable baseline or this stable neutral state has to be maintained. And for drug users, that's so tough because we take the drugs because we want to feel better and elated and euphoric. But the brain can and will, in every case, counteract that.
Which means that over time, you no longer get that euphoric feeling, and that leads to using more in search of that, right?
That's right. You can notice it in a single session, or you can notice it across time. So in a single session, after using cocaine or after drinking coffee even, you feel dysphoric or a little tired. So it's always there, but the brain is not only good at adapting, it's good at predicting this change. It's good at learning. So as you talked about the plasticity before, the brain recognizes patterns in our behavior. And if I'm a regular cocaine user and my brain knows it's coming, or a regular caffeine user, then the brain counteracts the effects of the drug kind of in preparation for the drug delivery. And that means that when I don't have the drug, I feel worse than normal. My baseline or my neutral state is low. And when I get the drug, I feel just right. So then I'm dependent.
Judy Grizel, having both lived and studied addiction, you're probably in the perfect position to try to define it. And you have one of the clearest delineations of what constitutes addiction in terms of the specific brain pathways that must be affected, and kind of what the difference is and what maybe the line is between dependence and addiction, because those two can be different, right?
Yes. So dependence is evident when you take away the drug and you feel less than normal. So I'm dependent for sure on caffeine, but
as are a lot of us.
Yes. Makes the world better, doesn't it? But if we take it away, if I take it away, I miss it. But it doesn't cause me any damage. In fact, there's some evidence that it's actually good for us. So it's not hurting other people. It's not hurting my relationships or my livelihood. And so for that reason, I don't have an addiction. So I think addiction has to have not only the dependence, but the craving and the obsession, spending time and money to get the drug at the cost of other good aspects of my life. So it's compromising my well-being rather than helping it.
Judy Grizel, 30 years sober, 25 years a neuroscience researcher studying addiction. Do you still think a cure is possible? And what do you think it might look like?
Yeah. Because I see addiction as a kind of a vulnerability to lots of factors in the environment, I think that, so a biologic vulnerability to those factors, I think that addressing both the biological influences and the environmental influences will be necessary to really help people. And I don't know, I think a cure is maybe unlikely. Others might disagree with me, so I think this is an empirical question, which is one great thing about science. If there's a cure, you know, we should keep working for it. But if there's not, there's certainly many things that we can do on the way to try to help. And I think that the research itself is pointing to a lot of those things.
Like what?
So it turns out, you know, just to be really quick about it, I thought it was going to be a simple problem in the brain. I'd flip the switch and be able to drink champagne or something. And it's not that simple. It's very much more complex. But that gives us lots of opportunities for intervening.
Judy Grizel is a professor of psychology at Bucknell University and author of Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.